Finish all the hot drinks. They clean the
All right, let's
kitchen
begin.
now.
So we're continuing with Amalek. Just go over what we did last time for the benefit of those who are new. So we were talking about, in general, Amalek, genocide, the war tactics of Bnei Israel in Tanakh. And what we noticed was that there are two separate places in the Torah itself, in the Chumash, where God says that he's going to take care of Amalek. And one of them, he basically says he's going to take care of Amalek, right? And in the other, he says that we should do something. He said, we have an obligation to blot out the memory of Amalek. Timche et zecher Amalek mitachat ha-shamayim. And that's what we read when we read Parshas Zachor. It's from Parshas Ki Teitze. And we see in Shmuel, in Sefer Shmuel, that it's expected that Shaul, once he begins to perform this mitzvah, which the Midrash says there were three mitzvot that waited until we got into Eretz Yisrael, appointing a king, destroying Amalek, and building the Beit HaMikdash. So once Shaul was supposed to do it, Shmuel was very upset that he, well, first of all, Shmuel was very clear what he wanted. He said, attack Amalek, prescribe all that belongs to him, right? Yachrim, spare no one, kill men and women, infants, suckling, oxen, sheep, camels, donkeys, nobody, men, women, children, grandparents, babies, animals, everything. Everything's got to go. That's Shmuel was very clear to Shaul when he said that. And Shaul didn't do it. We saw the Sefer Achinoch, which is the first Rishon that interests us. Sefer Achinoch takes all the way to the end and says, number one, there's a mitzvah in war to destroy Amalek, but even beyond that, I bolded and underlined it. He said, every single individual Jew has an obligation. If he ever runs into an individual Amalek that he can confirm is for sure from Amalek, he has an obligation to kill and destroy that person, no matter who they are, in any circumstance. Anybody. Well, so the Sefer Achinoch is clear about, in theory, what it means, and he doesn't see it only as a mitzvah of war, but he also sees it as a mitzvah of just eradicating the people.
Pure. Find Amalek?
The people. Well, for now, it just means the people come from that nation. Now, this made us deeply uncomfortable, so there was a good news, bad news type of thing. Well, I mean, the Gemara is good news. The Gemara in Brachos is the primary source that says that the whole thing has become irrelevant because we don't know who they are. We don't know who any of the nations are. All the nations were mixed up by Sancheriv, including us. That's where the 10 tribes, we don't know who they are. Everybody was mixed up, and therefore nowadays, we don't know who an Amalekite is, we don't know who an Amorite is, who an Ammonite is, who a Moabite is, we don't know. And so the whole thing became basically non-practical. Now, we went through some approaches towards this issue. One of them, that of Eugene Korn, he wrote an article, where he grabbed this Gemara in Brachos, and he kind of basically said that, you know, Rabbi Yoshua's point over here, that we don't know who they are, and therefore we can't perform the mitzvah, he's not convinced that it was totally muchrach, that it was necessary for Rabbi Yoshua to make this point. You know, for him to go out of his way and say, we know that this is true because of what happened with Sancheriv, and he reads the Pesukim in a certain way. He says, really, Rabbi Yoshua read it that way? Because he was deeply uncomfortable with this mitzvah. And the rabbis were deeply uncomfortable, and therefore the first moment that they got to get rid of it, basically, or to mitigate it, they took that opportunity. And that's their job. Their job is to use their intuition, to use their moral compass, in order to sort of soften the mitzvot of the Torah that occur to us as a little bit severe. So, for example, what they did to the Ben Sora Mora, basically darshening it out of existence because it's so hard to actually make it happen, the rebellious son. The Irani Dachat, capital punishment in general, that it requires two Edim and Hatra'ah and all of that, and the Mishnah and Makot that says, you know, the Batei Din were showing off how few times, how infrequently they actually enacted the death penalty on people. And so too, they did the same thing with Amalek. That's Eugene Koren's premise.
It occurred to me that Gemara really is worse than allowing Amalek the perspective, isn't it? It's basically, it's saying that this ger was allowed to be a ger, and the consequence of that isn't just that you're not killing someone.
Well, this was Ammon. He was an Ammonite.
Ammon, yeah. So it wasn't only that you can't kill.
He's allowed into the people.
I mean, which means that anyone which means allowed to marry into the nation. So this is much more permissive. So to say the only reason why that they did it was because they felt uncomfortable. Okay. It's one thing to come up with an excuse to not go around killing babies, but to say that they come up with an excuse to be muttering a gay who might not be allowed to be a gay into the people, that seems to be.
I see what you're saying. You're saying that Eugene Koren's point, if it was restricted to only Amalek, we could hear it, but the fact that it's not even the context in the Gemara.
Yeah,
it's not even the context of Amalek. It's just used afterwards like that. But the Gemara is only talking about allowing a convert in who might not have been allowed in, which it doesn't sound like from a moral perspective anybody had any issue with. It was just that Rabbi Yoshua said it's not an issue. It's not a problem. Yeah, I hear you. So that was Eugene Koren's position. I find it pretty radical. It's not the way that I personally, and I think most Orthodox Jews usually approach the way that Chazal wielded their power, so to speak. I think we usually assume that they're doing it based on sound analysis of the psukim or based on tradition, which there's no evidence from the Gemara that it's not being done that way, but that's not the way that he is reading it. Another approach that we saw, this is kind of a non-approach, is Rav Lichtenstein's basically shrug of the shoulders to say, look, greater and more empathic and more pious minds than mine have grappled with this issue, namely Rav Chaim of Brisk, who used to wake up every night to make sure that there wasn't a baby sitting on his doorstep, because there often was. And he was able to sleep. Other than that, he was able to sleep at night when he encountered the mitzvah of Amalek. So he said, if he can deal with it, then so can I, which is typical of Lichtenstein. In terms of his humility. We saw this amazing line by Rav Henkin, who doesn't really speak about the mitzvah itself, but just about the stories of the Tanakh about war, and basically says you shouldn't try to learn anything, any practical lessons about war from Tanakh, because it's kind of like a different world. That's why he says that's why we sing the Tanakh, because it's kind of to separate ourselves from it, to make it almost, I don't know, fairy tale like, something like that, which is pretty amazing that he would say that. And then some other much more political or practical approaches, similar approaches by Rav Kook and Rav Karmi's quotation from Rav Yoel Ben Nun. Rav Kook basically says, look, in terms of the way that Am Yisrael conducted themselves in war and how severe and how ferocious they were told to be, he says, Dafka, that was because if they didn't act that way, then people wouldn't take them seriously. This is the way that everybody conducted war. Everybody was doing it this way. And if you did it any less, then people would capitalize on that weakness. They would see you as weak and they would come after you. So they had to do it that way. Rav Yoel Ben Nun takes a little bit of more of what I would call an apologetic stance, and says that basically, in his mind, the Jewish mentality, if Simon's not here last time, he's the one who said that the whole thing seems very non-Jewish, which I challenged him, what does that mean? But yeah, Rav Yoel Ben Nun says the Jewish mentality is to be much more peaceful. And so in order to kind of swing us all the way to the other side, God had to ask us to do it with ferocity so that we wouldn't risk a collective loss of nerve. In other words, sometimes you just have to shut off that switch in your brain that says to be compassionate, and you have to go all out in order to survive, and that's what was necessary. Okay, none of that will really help us with the full extent of the Sefer HaChinuch's read, namely that if you run into somebody on the street, you have to do something about it. That none of them have helped us with that, really. Rav Yaakov Meidan, this is what we were up to last time. Rav Yaakov Meidan has two approaches over here that I thought were important to highlight. One, I think it's a little bit of what my father was talking about last time. One, he mentions the Ramban's explanation about what Amalek is. So he says, Amalek bears the flag of heresy. At a time when all the nations recognized God's kingship, Amalek found it necessary to demonstrate his ability to wage war against God's nation. In light of this, the fact that the war took place so close to Mount Horeb, where God's kingship was supposed to be entirely revealed, becomes especially significant. It says, after the victory of Amalek, the rest of the revelation at Sinai took place. It was almost as if the fight against Amalek was orchestrated by God in order to be like, first you eradicate evil and then you accept God's commandments. and that it was kind of part of the natural revelation of God's will. But then he quotes Rav Tzadok, who adopts a different approach. A malik, to his view, represents principally the power of false imagination that reigns in the world and the apparent perfection of its strength and logic. Therefore, the essence of the war against him lies in the spiritual realm. This approach, like that of Ramban, understands the crux of the war waged by Amalek as being directed against faith in God and his service, and therefore the war against him is a commandment. Many Hasidic works follow this view of Rav Tzadok, especially the Sfat Emet. In other words, what the Rav Tzadok started and was taken upon completely by the Hasidic view is that Amalek is not just a people, but is an idea. Most famously, Amalek is the gematria of Safek, and that it represents the attack, theological attack, against God. And so Rav Tzadok has kind of shifted the focus. If last time we talked about how Amalek, I think we kind of branded them as pirates, right? If you remember, people who attack weak people or people who just love to fight and they're evil and they're just subhuman and they're just terrible people, and therefore they need to be eradicated because they are bad. Rav Tzadok says, no, they represent heresy. They represent war against God. They weren't, Amalek wasn't attacking Bnei Israel. They were attacking the idea of God. And based on that, so he kind of morphs them into just a representative of the Yetzer Hara, of Kfira, of that spirit of heresy. And in that vein, it takes on these apocalyptic proportions of war against Amalek is the war of good against evil. And not even just moral good and evil, but actual theological good and evil. And so I think that probably helps us the most with Sefer Achinuch, maybe, if you somehow see even every Amalek baby as representative of that. But it's not even necessarily the way that he sees it. He sees it as being a little bit broader than that, in fact. And he says, among contemporary thinkers, if you look at the underlined part, Rav Soloveitchik was his staunchest supporter, claiming that those who sow hatred of Israel in the world are the disciples and ideological descendants of Amalek. And he said this about the Holocaust, about the Nazis. Basically, Rav Soloveitchik was of the opinion, this is written up in Harei Kedem, which is a shiurim that were recorded by Rav Michal Shurkin, which I think I have in English on the next side of the page. This is attributed, from? What?
Michal Shurkin, where is he from?
America, New York. He was in, what? Or Boston? No, probably Bar Park. He was Haredi. He was the Haredi version of Schechter, I guess. So here's an English, I think this is an English translation of Harei Kedem. This is actually a view that Rav Soloveitchik attributed to his father that's written up in a lot of places, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So he read the Rambam at the bottom of the page with Rav Yaakov Midan. The Rambam says, Mitzvah tasei l'achrim shiva amamin, shneemar hachrim tachrimim, v'chol sheba liyado achad me'en v'lo harago, over v'lo tasei shneemar lo techaya kol hashama, v'kvar avad zichram. So the Rambam actually puts that in, by the way. He says, there's a mitzvah to destroy them, even if they come in front of you, but we don't know where they are. They're gone. V'chein mitzvah taseh la'abed zichar Amalek. Separately, there's a mitzvah taseh to get rid of Amalek. Shnei ra'atim chet zichar Amalek. U'mitzvah taseh lizkor tamin ma'asav ra'im ba'arivato. Kedei la'orer ra'ivato. Shnei ma'ar zichor ha'teshu ha'salach Amalek. The mitzvah to remember them, to remember him, remember Amalek, is to actually inspire us, to keep our blood boiling. That's the purpose of that. We're not allowed to forget him and our hatred of him and his hatred of us, really. And Rabbi Soloveitchik points out his father, who said that there is a mitzvah to blot out the memory of Amalek, which is incumbent upon everyone. And B, there's a mitzvah for the community to engage in communal military preparedness for war against Amalek, like it says in Bishalach. And, however, with regards to the other nations, is only a mitzvah of war. In other words, there's no mitzvah to kill individuals. That's not sure, though. It does say that.
It's an idea.
Which does not apply to any other nation that applies to... he says, he points out that according to the Rambam, you don't know that we should be applying the Gemara in Brachos. If you look at the bottom, according to the Rambam never says that the Zecher of Amalek is gone. You'll notice that in the first halakha, he says, Kfar Avad Zichram, that was talking about the nations, the other nations, that's the seven nations of Canaan. Shiva Amimin. That doesn't include Amalek. In the second halacha that talks about Amalek, he never says it. Now, it's true, we don't know who Amalek is, so what's the explanation? So Moshe Soloveitchik says Amalek is an idea, and it could be represented by other nations, namely the Nazis or anybody else who wants to destroy Bnei Israel wholesale for no good reason.
When was the last time we actually acted on this?
When is the first time we acted on
it?
Right, so Shaul is obviously the first time. We will have another time. We will see another time, which is questionable whether or not it was acting on this or not. Nope, not in recent history, obviously. But there is another place shortly after Shaul where Amalek shows up and stuff happens. There's also before Shaul with... No, that's not... No, after Shaul, it does happen again. Everything we've seen so far has been trying to deal with, with the Sefer HaChinuch.
No, Rav Soloveitchik doesn't seem to agree with the Rav Tzadok's position. It's like an idea.
In what sense?
He's talking about his idea to go out and fight. Whereas Rav Tzadok is talking about the whole idea of America is not a people, but it's an ethos.
Who says that?
Rav Tzadok
said it was about the Kfira. Right. Rav Tzadok says about Kfira. You're right. And versus Rabbi Soloveitchik, how do you see Rav Soloveitchik? Those who sow hatred of Israel. Well, I mean, Rav Tzadok also says you have to go out and wage war. It's just that Rav Tzadok kind of allegorizes Amalek as being just evil in general. And Rabbi Soloveitchik sees it more as anti-Semitism. That seems to be the difference between them. Everything we've seen so far has kind of been trying to deal with the Sefer HaChinuch's version of this mitzvah. And not so successfully, I think, because he took it all the way to say, you know, it's about individuals. It's hard to see this that way. But there is another way to read it. This is Rav Nati Halfgat's reading of the Rambam. Before we get to the Rambam, first let's look once again at the Torah. We kind of pointed this out last time. When you look in the Chumash, you don't get such stark terms when it comes to Amalek itself. You know, we saw from Parshas Kitetze. No, this is not Parshas Kitetze. This is the beginning of Devarim. This is actually talking about going to war against the other nations. There it says, you must doom them to destruction, grant them no terms, and give them no quarter. So in other words, when it comes to the seven nations of Canaan, you're not allowed to grant them any quarter, you're not allowed to hold back, right? But is that true? It seems pretty simple, right? But it's not, because when you go a little bit further, and you get to, I think this is Parshas Kitetze, in Devarim Chaf, he says, when you approach a town to attack it, you shall offer it terms of peace. We do offer them peace. If it responds peaceably, lets you in. All the people present there shall serve you at forced labor. All right, it's not a very, you know, it's not a very good offer, but you know, they could leave if they want. If it does not surrender to you, but would join battle with you, you shall lay siege to it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. You may, however, take as your booty the women, the children. Okay, you do take spoils, but you do give them the option to either make peace or to leave. You know, it's not as if we're told to commit genocide just for the sake of genocide. They can leave, or they can join us. Those are the options. Yeah, they're not, you know, great options for them, but it's not as if we're being told to just go out and kill everybody indiscriminately. And the Ramban points out, he says, Kriyat HaShalom afilo b'melchemet mitzvahi. This applies even in a melchemet mitzvah, if you had any questions. Shechayevim likol l'shalom afilo l'shiva amamin. Even those seven nations. Okay, fine. There are differences, but for the most part, we are willing to make peace with them. Now, here's an interesting thing. So the Mechilta says as follows. The Mechilta, this is a Medrash on Beshalach. Rabbi Eliezer, presumably Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, says that if anyone from the nations of the world comes to convert to Judaism, he should be accepted. If he is a Malek, he should not be accepted. Okay. This seems reasonable, no? I mean, it seems unsurprising. Basically, anybody who wants to become a convert is allowed to. There are some conditions for some of the nations, the Mitzri, the Adomi, that you have to wait a certain amount of years. But he's basically saying, Amalek will never be accepted. Think this is, you know, okay, fine. Now, Jake, you asked about any other times in Tanakh where we encounter Amalek. So here, you have a story in Shmuel Beis, the first parak of Shmuel Beis, after the death of Shaul. How did Shaul die? Anybody remember?
Fell on the sword.
No. Did he fall his own sword?
Seems like he did.
Well, he was kind of helped, let's say. He was facilitated by somebody. Who was he facilitated by? Basically his squire. Now, who his squire is interesting. After the death of Saul, David had already returned from defeating the Amalekites. David stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, a man came from Shaul's camp with his clothes rent in earth on his head, and he approached David. He flung himself to the ground and bowed low. David said to him, "Where are you coming from?" He says, "I have just escaped from the camp of Israel." "What happened?" asked David. "Tell me." He told him how the troops had fled the battlefield and that, moreover, many of the troops had fallen and died. Also, that Shaul and his son Jonathan were dead. "How do you know?" David asked the young man who brought him the news, "that Shaul and his son Jonathan are dead." The young man who brought him the news answered, "I happened to be at Malkoa, and I saw Saul leaning on his spear and the chariots and horsemen closing in on him. He looked around and saw me, and he called to me. When I responded, 'At your service,' he asked me, 'Who are you?' And I told him that I was an Amalekite. Well, then he said to me, 'Stand over me and finish me off, for I am in agony and I am barely alive.' So I stood over him and finished him off, for I knew that he would never rise from where he was lying. When I took the crown from his head and the armlet from his arm, and I brought him here to my lord." This is an incredible story, right? This is amazing. David obviously, you know, he gets very upset. He's mourning, mostly Yonatan, but also Shaul. He's very upset. David said to the young man who had brought him the news, "Where are you from?" He replied, "I'm the son of a resident alien, Amalekite. I am a ger, Amaleki." This guy was in the Jewish army. He wasn't just there. "How did you dare," David said to him, "lift your hand and kill the Lord's anointed?" Anybody ever asks you if Mashiach ever shows up in Tanakh, tell him he shows up all over the place. Because David calls everybody Mashiach. He calls himself Mashiach, he calls Shaul Mashiach, because Mashiach just means anointed, which is every king. Thereupon, David called one of the attendants and said to him, "Come over and strike him." He killed the guy. He killed the messenger. He struck him down and died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, 'I put the Lord's anointed to death.'" So why did David kill this guy?
From the words of Pesachim, it sounds like, because he admitted to killing
the king. Because he killed the king. And even if the king asked him to, right? Nevertheless, right? Similar to we just learned the Sugda of Chukatim Lotelech on how they burn all the king's stuff. Sounds almost like that. You know, you kill the king, it doesn't matter if the king asks you to kill him. You know, that's the death penalty. That seems pretty simple, right? It seems pretty straightforward, open shut. What about the fact that he was from Malik? There's a few issues here. Number one, it sounds like he was a convert. He was part of the Jewish people. So it sounds like.
Second generation.
Yeah, not even that far off, right? This is David, Shaul. And other than that, you know, why didn't David kill him? Because he was an Amaleki. Mm-hmm. Like the Sefer Chinuch says. He identified himself. So the Mechilta over here says, on the Navi, at the same moment that the lad identified himself as an Amalekite, David remembered that it was said to Moses, our teacher, if one comes from the nations. Immediately David said to him, "Your blood be upon your head, for your mouth testified against you." In other words, the Midrash rereads the whole Navi and says, no, the real reason why David killed him was because he was Amalek. But that's not, I mean, that doesn't sound like what happened.
I mean, also begin the pasuk as if one comes from the nation.
What?
What's the end of that pasuk?
If one comes from the nations?
Yeah. How is, like, what is he remembering? Isn't
the Pasuk in the Torah.
He knew the drosha of Rabbi Eliezer. Song for the nations and not a Malek.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
Otherwise.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Okay.
So it seems to be rereading it as, yeah, this is very much in the vein of the Sefer Achinuch, that he's killing him because of that. Now, why did I put this pasuk here? Oh, this is just to show that it's far from clear from the Chumash that means that you have to kill him. I think I've kind of messed up the order over here. Let's try to find our way. Ah, it comes up again, by the way, at the end of the same perek. By the time David and his men arrived in Siklag on the third day, right, the war against with Shaul, the Amalekites had made a raid into the Negev and against Siklag. They had stormed Siklag and burnt it down. They had taken the women in a captive, lowborn, highborn alike. So the Amalekites were going on a rampage. David attacked them from before dawn until the evening of the next day. None of them escaped except 400 young men. Okay, so these 400 Amalekites escaped. David rescued everything Amalekites had taken, and he also rescued two wives. What did he not do?
Chase after them.
He didn't go after them. He didn't chase after them in order to kill them and destroy everything. And he took spoils.
Was he king yet?
Yeah. He took spoils. So what ends up happening is that when we actually look at the stories, this is the beginning of Shmuel Bet. Oh, this is actually Shmuel Aleph. I'm sorry. You're right. This is Shmuel Aleph. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, he's not fully king yet. No, because Shaul is still alive.
Right, I'm saying.
Matter.
It gives yeah because it's a, it's a midst of a king and the king's army. Maybe.
Who says it's the midst of the king's army?
Not the Chinuch, but maybe that would be like a way
to read the Rambam. Maybe. So. What we see, though, at least two stories here. The simple read is that it's far from clear that you have to actually kill every single individual everywhere you find them.
Or that David's just not following the rules.
Right, but it would be hard to see that David's not following the rules. I mean, Shaul is punished Dafka because of this rule. We'd expect that if there was a rule that David would keep, it would be this one.
Oh, he'd been told explicitly by Shmuel.
That's right.
But David, he wasn't the king at the time, and he hadn't been told that. So
you mean Shaul had been told explicitly by Shmuel what to do. So isn't it possible that what Shaul was being criticized for wasn't the din of the Torah, but it was for failing to do what Shmuel had said in this instance, right? We've been reading Shmuel's story and Shaul's story as being representative of what the Torah wants in the Chumash, but it may have been something extra at that moment and not something so basic. If we look in the Rambam actually writes in Hilchos Malachim, "V'im lo yishlimu, o sheyishlimu, v'lo kiblu shavu mitzvos." If they don't make peace, these are the nations that we're attacking, if they don't make peace, or they make peace, but they don't accept the seven shavu mitzvos b'nei Noach, o sinim ayin malchama, you make war against them. V'horgin kol zecherim agdoli, u'bozin kol mamanam v'tapam, v'horgin isha v'lo katan, we take spoils. Fine. B'med v'arim amurim, b'melchemet harishut, shuhim shara umot. That's with the rest of the nations. Avah, that's with, you know, an offensive war. Avah shiva amamin, v'amalek shalei shlimu, but then you don't leave over anything of theirs. Right, exactly. Says even about this second half, and how do we know we're talking about only the nations that don't make peace? Because they did make peace with some of the nations. He seems to be including Amalek amongst the nations that you can optionally make peace with. That is possible to make peace with Amalek. And look at how the Rambam reads the story with David. This is a totally separate din. It says that there's a rule that you don't kill somebody in Beit Din if your only evidence is their mouth. In other words, if they have, you know, admitted to a crime for themselves, then they can't get the death penalty for that. You need to have two witnesses. Oh, v'zeh Yehoshua Achan v'David lager ha'amaleki. What about how Yehoshua killed Achan, who admitted that he had taken the spoils? Or David killed Amaleki, who admitted that he had killed Shaul? Two options. Either it was an extreme situation, and David just made a split-second decision. It wasn't in his capacity as the Beit Din, because he wasn't the Beit Din. It was just a decision that he made to do, or it's his right as king to do whatever he wants. But it wasn't Medina de Gemara, it wasn't like Halacha that required him to kill the Amalekites. So you can't learn from that story. He's obviously disregarding the Mechilta. It's not like David was looking in the Torah and saying, this is what the rule is. No.
At the time, he wasn't king.
And he wasn't king.
Well, he had been anointed already.
Yes.
So he was.
But it doesn't matter. Yeah. Either way, the Rambam is saying that the whole decision was just, it was a split-second decision that made sense at the time for him. Yeah, there's nothing to learn from it. Kol ha'akum kulam, the Rambam says. Kol ha'ovdei kuchavim kulam. They can all accept the Torah. Who's missing from this list? Amalek. There's no restrictions whatsoever. It sounds like even first generation Amalek. Unlike Moab, and there's no problem with getting a ger from Amalek. The Rambam Paskins, there's no problem with getting a ger from Amalek. And you know where he got it from? He got it from the Gemara. The Gemara in Gittin says, Atana taught, Naaman was a resident alien, Nuvazaradan was a righteous proselyte, which means a ger. Descendants of Haman learned the Torah in Bnei Brak. Now, who do we believe that Naaman was a descendant from? Agag, Amaleki.
Yeah.
Descendants of Haman. Descendants of Sisra, descendants of Sancheiriv. Who are the Ishmael and Avtalion? Basically, the Gemara in Gittin seems to say that you can accept Gerim from Amalek, unlike Rabbi Eliezer's Mechilta. The Achronim are bothered by this. The Avnei Nezer, the Tzitz Eliezer, they both dealt with it. The Avnei Nezer, the Sakat Rabbi Rabbi, he says, he wants to say that the Shiva Amamin, so they do all the toivot, and therefore they're chayav mita. V'hav amina shelo yo'il tshuva. And therefore their tshuva doesn't work. Kama kol chayav mitot. Okay, where's he going? Aval zera amalek. What about amalek? Shnen shin ba'avon avotam. They are punished for what their fathers did. In other words, he's saying almost the opposite, sounds like, of what we attributed to the Hasidish rabbis, to the Rasisei Laila of Tzadok. Because Rav Tzadok says it's something actually inborn in Amalek, it's the way that they are. But he's saying, no, Pasha Pshat, remember we said this last time, Pasha Pshat, in the Psukim, in Chumash, why are we commanded to destroy Amalek, to remove his memory from the earth? Why? Because he did what? Because he attacked us as we were leaving Egypt. In other words, the whole thing, according to a simple reading of the Chumash, is retribution. They did this to us, they've got to pay. Did the children do anything to us? No, but they have to pay anyways. Do we attribute any evilness to the children? The Torah doesn't. But they have to pay for the sins of their fathers. Okay. And that bothers the Avnei Nezer. He says, Avalzera Malik Shinasin Nanchin Ba'avon Avotam. But we're told in the Torah that you're not supposed to punish people for what their fathers did. Even if the hatred is actually in their hearts, look, they continue that way. Haman continues that way. And when they continue their ways of their forefathers, then you do take it upon them. Aval im asu tshuva vekiblu sheva mitzvot hayinochzin maasei avoteim b'yadeim b'shuvein anashim b'avon avotam. He says, the moment you get proof that they're not ocheiz v'avon avotam, that they are not continuing the ways of their forefathers, and proof of that would be if they do tshuva, then we can accept them as gerim. In other words, Amalek is not irredeemable, according to the Avnei Nezer. They're very redeemable. The moment they show us that they are no longer like their forefathers, we have no problem accepting them into the Kehila. But until they do that, then we take out our retribution on their fathers, on them.
Something innate in them, but they can overwhelm them.
I don't even think that's the focal point. I mean, I know he said that. He suggested that it might be, but I don't even think that's the focal point. I think the focal point is we do punish them for what their forefathers did because we assume that they're going to continue that way until they prove otherwise.
unless they kill another human.
Right. Seems to be the way that he understands the whole sugya. The Tzitz Eliezer as well, he points out the stira between the Mechilta and the Gemara about whether or not we accept them as converts. Kivon acher la'amid et ha-Mechilta bo'kimta ra'iti shekotev l'faresh ha-gaon ha-chazon ish al ha-Rambam v'ayinu z'kavonat ha-Mechilta d'l'acha shenechnesu l'milchama ein mekablin otan. That it could be the Mechilta saying that once we go to war with them, then we don't accept them as gerim. The b'shar umot mekablin afachar kach v'lo'yaniach dalet nin no'yaniach Hashem nin v'nechad ha-malek ha-inu bo'osem ma'asa ha-malek. He said something similar. He says, that's only as long as they're continuing that way. They're going to war against us. He attributes this to the Nativ as well, by the way. So what we see, though, is that according to the Rambam, is there a mitzvah to go after every Amalek that you find? No, because we see that in Tanakh, that's mostly not what happened. David goes and doesn't go after every Amalek that he finds. Even in the context of the war, he doesn't go running after them. And that's just not what we see happening. So what do we do with what Shmuel said to Shaul? So we have two options. One option is to say, yeah, fine, that's what Shmuel said to Shaul, but that's not necessarily the din ledorot. The other option, Rabbi Helfgott suggests, is even the phrase infant and suckling does not imply genocide in the sense of killing every single Amalekite one meets on the street. It was a turn of the phrase. Even Shmuel didn't want that. Rather, we should understand this phrase as only being applicable in the context of war. When at war with Amalek, we must be willing to make no compromises even when it comes to bombing civilian locales. This is the nature of war under certain circumstances. It is, in fact, what the U.S. did during World War II. This is not an injunction to be taken on by private individuals. God has not commanded each and every Israelite to become an assassin waging private war against Amalek. Unlike the Sefer Chinuch, that was never the intention. The intention was never to wipe out every single person. This is a war mitzvah. When you go to war against Amalek, no quarter given. That doesn't mean you have to go and kill the babies. That's not what that means. It means if the baby's in the way, then that's how you wage war. But that doesn't mean you have to run after every baby, slaughtering every single one. That's not just not what it means.
Well, I mean, okay. According to the Medrash, the fact that they turned into animals.
The babies?
No, as in, that's how he hid. He turned into an animal. That's why.
It could be. I don't remember.
Whether or not that's...
Could be. But the point being, though, that Rabbi Helfgott is pointing out that there is another version of this where it's merely a mitzvah of war, and it's really not a surprising mitzvah of war. If you take the infant and suckling, the baby and the women and all that, it's not saying run after them. It's just saying don't hold back. And you know what? Until 50 years ago, that's the way people did war. No, we have to be honest. Until 50 years ago, there was no inyan of civilian casualties. That didn't exist. It's just nowadays this. That's the way we see war, but it was never the way that we saw war before. You know, England bombed what's it called? Dresden, and Germany bombed London, and America bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and people were upset, but they weren't critical really, because it was just the way. That's the way you do war, and if you can, then you do. And before it was, it was even more barbaric in a sense because it wasn't being dropped by bed. You were actually going out and killing them with your hands. So the idea that in a war this is the way it was being conducted, it doesn't come off as being that barbaric when you see it through the sweep of history. It may not be the way that we conduct war nowadays. We've kind of agreed not to do that, although not everybody's really agreed. But it's not so surprising it should be that way. If you eliminate the Sefer Achinoch's read, the mitzvah itself doesn't come off as being that barbaric, I don't think. Because it doesn't leave the battlefield, really. That's what I had prepared. How do we do? How do we do? I think we took a very difficult mitzvah, and we saw it from a few different perspectives. I think we dealt with it fairly, realistically. If you accept the Sefer Chinuch's read, then you have serious issues.
Which is interesting, isn't basically we all came in. I definitely came in with the assumption that the Sefer Chinuch's reading is the one that
right.
has been taught to us as children. So like that was
the one that we recognize.
But it didn't.
And we were only okay with it because we knew that it would never actually come into play.
Or we weren't okay with it, like, Lichtenstein, but yet.
Right. But when you look through, Rabbi Hofgott's main point is when you look through Tanakh, we see that it's not implemented that way.
Can I ask something which is probably a very stupid question, because I wasn't here last week. The actual pasuk in Devarim is to block out Zecher Amalek.
Right.
Eliminate Amalek.
No, it doesn't. But the Torah, like we said, you're right. You're absolutely right. The Torah is quite vague on exactly what we're supposed to be doing there. In one pasuk, it doesn't even tell us to do anything. It just says God's going to take care of it. Yeah. In another pasuk, he tells us to do something, but what? It you know, it almost sounds like a spiritual crusade more than it does, you know.
So the problem is this Sefer HaChinuch.
Well, but to be fair to the Sefer HaChinuch, the problem is really Shmuel, right? Shmuel told Shaul, you have to destroy everybody. So you have to kill everybody.
Maybe that was just in that particular instance.
Right, so there's room to say that was only in that particular instance. The halakha does recognize that there is a war that's meant to be waged against Amalek, that we're supposed to take it out on them, but what form that has to take... It's not, you know, it's not really totally explained. Like many things are not explained in Chumash. And it's all a matter of, you know, where we put the emphasis and how we see it. And I think there's a lot of basis to say that the Sefer Chinuch, his read is not the only read. Especially once you accept the idea that you could have Amalek converts. I mean, and that's a serious position taken in the Gemara and how the Rambam understands it. I mean,
Shkoyach.
Shkoyach.